You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 40 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you live from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion, Seattle Seahawks.
Hello.
Happy, may I be the first to wish you a happy National Signing Day.
Oh, happy National Signing Day to you. Wait, was this coming out on Groundhog Day?
I don't know. When is Groundhog Day?
I feel like it's coming out on Groundhog Day. And if it does come out on Groundhog Day, I would love to be the first to wish you a happy Groundhog Day.
Wow. I mean, I would really appreciate that if it was so. Groundhog Day is, yes! It is coming out on Groundhog
there
Day.
There it is.
And if we keep recording for more than a half hour, which I predict that we will, then you can wish me a happy, be the first to wish me a happy Groundhog Day.
Yeah, we could never be so lucky to record for less than half, both the listener and each of us having to hear each other talk.
Only on a post-game podcast. We got a lot to get to today, including, of course, a full recap of the Huskies 2017 recruiting class.
Yeah, this signing day is spectacular.
But first, where do we want to start off with here? Beer?
Let's start off with beer.
We have here a couple of beers from Hair of the Dog Brewing Company, which I did not realize was located in Portland.
Yeah, located in Portland.
We could go there sometime. We have both the Adam and the Fred. The Adam, a hearty old world ale, and the Fred, a golden special ale. And I've looked these up on Beer Advocate, where, you know, the Fred is pretty good. Gets a score of 91, 93 from the bros. Okay. I mean, very solid. But it pales in comparison to the Adam.
Oh, the Adam is where it's at.
Adam raised a cane or something. I don't know. I don't know what the metaphor is here, but which gets a score of 94 and a 98 from the bros. So,
really? A 98 from the bros?
I don't know. After hearing that, whether you want to crack open the higher rated one first or the lower rated one.
We should do the
one.
Higher rated one first.
Okay, so that's
because we're probably not going to talk about the other one.
Yeah, that's probably true. Again, the Adam.
I have been collecting these beers from Hair of the Dog. I have four different Hair of the Dog beers. I have not ever drank any Hair of the Dog beer. This will be my first time trying it. But I have bought four different individual 12-ounce bottles just because I feel like I've heard people say that they were good at some point. And Hair of the Dog beers are meant to age in the bottle. They're in 12-ounce bottles, and the longer that they age, supposedly the better that they taste, similar to a barrel-aged beer. This is very dark.
So how long have you been aging these particular ones?
Approximately 1 month.
Okay.
I don't know if that's... Well, cheers to a solid National Signing Day.
Yeah.
And Groundhog Day.
Yeah. There you go. After that, let's give this a try and see how it is with the 1 month aging process. What do you think?
It's pretty good.
Yeah. It's not quite what I expected.
I thought it was... It almost like the first taste is a little bit fruity.
I don't know if I got that.
Then it becomes a little bit maltier.
Yeah, it's definitely very malty. So speaking of things trying for the first time.
Okay.
Do you know what I tried for the first time today?
What was that?
You probably don't. Tats Delicatessen.
Oh, you went to Tats?
I finally went to Tats.
What did you think of Tats?
It was pretty darn good. I got the chicken parm.
Okay, chicken parm. See, they don't have that at the Tats truck. I've only been to the Tats truck, and they don't do chicken parm on the truck.
It's a little bit of a weird chicken parm, because they just put like their chicken strips in there and make a chicken parm out of it. But if there's like a baked layer of cheese at the top, and that you're going to want that baked layer of cheese.
Oh, you always want a baked layer. Like, what is the situation where I'm like, baked layer of cheese? I don't know.
I
could probably think of some situations, yeah. But... Like baked layer of cheese.
So it's your ice cream with the baked layer of cheese
on top.
That
would be really good.
I don't think that would be good. I don't
know. Nowhere near the grossest thing that you could have come up with.
But it's something that would be good on its own, but cheese with it wouldn't be good, is what I was trying to go for here.
Okay. You said it was pretty good.
Yes.
See, I feel like you need to go with like a cheesesteak.
I probably should in hindsight have done that. But chicken parm is like my favorite type of sandwich, and I don't know that I have a good chicken parm that I get on a regular basis in Seattle.
Wow, you are really drinking that drink. To me, it's they have a sandwich that has Russian dressing on it. And I want Russian dressing. on every single food with the big cheese.
Yeah, your feelings, you've made your feelings on Russian dressing well known.
Have I? Wait, when am I talking about this?
I don't know. I think probably when we talked about maybe a little Woody's burger.
Oh, I don't think so. But I want to tell you, I felt like, so this is a burger month at Little Woody's.
It is.
It's a Seattle burger chain. There are three of them now. And in the past, what they've done is if there's a different Seattle chef that has made a special burger for each week of Burger Month.
Uh-huh.
And if you get all of them, there's some sort of prize at the end. And in the past, I haven't been able to do it, but this year is the year.
I mean, you have a Little Woody's within like a couple of blocks from your office.
There's no excuse for me not getting each of the Burger Month burgers.
I 100% agree here.
So I went for the first Burger Month burger. It's from Rachel Yang of Jewel in Seattle and then also Trove. Have you heard of either of those?
Nope.
Trove is like four restaurants in one, which is also, it's like a block away from Little Woody's.
Okay.
In like lower Capitol Hill, First Hill area. It's like a Korean barbecue, like a noodle place, ice cream.
Interesting.
Yeah, there's like an outdoor ice cream stand. It's pretty good. Maybe that, not as good as I want it to be.
Okay. What is as good as you want it to be?
What is as good as I want it to be? Yeah, maybe that, this beer.
Was that burger as good as you wanted it to be?
Well, so let me tell you about the Rachel Yang burger. It's called Yang's Burger, the Relay Burger. So it has pickled Korean peppers and onions, caramelized bacon kimchi mayo, butter lettuce, half-pound Painted Hills grass-fed beef, and they had another layer of mayo on there. There are two different mayos. There's a top mayo and a bottom mayo.
Okay, I'm liking that. And is the way you reacted to the baked layer of cheese, that's how I feel about caramelized. For some reason, I'm in on anything that is caramelized.
Oh, really? Caramelized is what you're in on.
I don't know why. It just sounds good.
It was a good burger, I have to say. I would deem it just fine.
Okay.
Like, if I'm going to, at the end of the month, obviously, be rating these burgers.
Obviously.
And
it wouldn't be the Pelton cast if you weren't ranking them.
I don't, and I'm going to be wearing my hat that I'll have gotten for getting all four burgers.
Yeah.
When ranking them. It'll be one of my proudest moments, getting that hat.
It will say, "Make America Burger Again." I don't know what it would be.
We don't have to do that thing as a country. But there was a lot of something called butter lettuce, which I'm pretty sure is not a thing.
Butter and lettuce are individually things, but together I don't think they make any sense.
Butter lettuce. It was just a lot of lettuce. There was not enough caramelized. Honestly, there were two different types of mayo. I could have used even more mayo, though.
Wow.
It just wasn't flavorful enough, really. It was more kind of like having a burger and just some giant pieces of lettuce.
Yeah, as you describe it that way, that's not sounding that appetizing to me.
And, you know, every burger is different, right? I may have just gotten a slightly less flavorful burger, but to me, it shouldn't enter a regular rotation for Little Woody's.
Okay, good to know. Is that all we have on the food department this week?
The food department. Let's check in next week if we're going to be doing a bracket or a ranking of some kind.
What should we do now? Husky basketball?
Sure. Might as well just get that out of the way.
Yeah, let's start there. I just came from attending the Huskies' loss tonight. What was the final? 82-76? 82-74.
Who cares? USC. What does it matter?
Huskies were ahead by 10 at halftime after a poor shooting first half for the Trojans, and they significantly regressed to the mean after the halftime. And it was still a close game in the final minute. Huskies had a Matisse Thybulle three that would have tied it. Ugh. And that rattled out.
Going.
And
did you think it was going when you were there?
I did. And then Markelle Fultz fouled going for the rebound, and that was basically it for the game.
Such a frustrating game. I mean, so we have this and then the game last Sunday at Arizona, which, by the way, do we just play on Wednesdays now? Is that what the deal is? Whatever happened to Thursday, Saturday?
It makes me very unhappy. You know how much of a traditionalist I am when it comes to college sports, except for that they should probably pay the players. But but when it comes to scheduling, I am a traditionalist.
Yes.
And they should always play on Thursday and Saturday in the Pac-12.
I hate it. I mean, I understand that it's just to get on TV, right?
Yes.
But
people complained before about TV. Now they complain about when the games are. people will always be unhappy. Moral of the story.
The Huskies play every game on Wednesday at 8 o'clock, which...
This means that's when ESPNU has a spot, and we're like the official team of ESPNU at this point. We're like slightly better than just the Pac-12 network, although weirdly Saturday's game against UCLA, which is like the most exciting game, one of the two most exciting games of the year from a draft standpoint, is going to be on the Pac-12 network.
Really?
Yeah. Interesting. But for the most part, we're like slightly better than that. But not good enough for, like, actual ESPN or FS1.
Did you talk to Danny Ainge at the game?
I did not. I saw Danny Ainge.
But you didn't talk to him? Were there other scouts there?
There were a number of scouts there, yes. I think one other GM I heard, Scott Layden of the Timberwolves, and then a handful of other, like, lower scouts.
Well, I think this was a particularly frustrating loss. I mean, this and the Arizona loss. Granted, we didn't expect to win at Arizona, right? But both of these games were games where the Huskies came out and played really good basketball. At Arizona, I thought they actually kept it through the second half. But in this game, I felt like the last 10 minutes or so, it seemed like offensively in particular, they got very, very tight. And defensively, some of the issues that we've seen in other games. First half, defense was not bad. Second half, all of a sudden... USC is getting behind them for wide open layups. I mean, an alley-oop almost any time that we played zone. Wide open threes. Kind of the same defensive issues that they've had. And then those last 10 minutes were... The first 30 minutes were, this is what this team can be. The last 10 minutes were, this is what this team is.
The first 30 minutes were, you were telling it like how it might be. And the last 10 minutes were, I'm telling it like it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think all of that is accurate. I mean, a big difference in the game, besides everything else you mentioned, what I mentioned in terms of just the shooting regressing, was foul trouble for both Benny Boatwright, who was coming back from a sprained MCL.
The hell? Why is this the case? Does every team feel like this, by the way?
I'm sure they do. It's like a classic case of confirmation bias, but you're never going to remember, oh yeah, there's a ton of teams guys that get hurt against us. Or are out against us. You're going to remember the guys who come back against you.
It feels like Husky, both football and basketball, have a disproportionate amount of players who end up playing their first game when they're playing the Huskies.
I mean,
and
Alonzo Trier
is the best player on the court after Markel Fultz.
He was, yeah. Alonzo Trier wasn't his first game. It was his second game back. But yeah, same thing where rough scheduling, where if the Huskies had caught these guys at home in the first half of the season, might have been different. So... Boatwright in the first half only played 4 minutes because of foul trouble. He scored 7 points in those 4 minutes. In the second half, he played 17. D'Anthony Melton, his foul trouble wasn't quite as serious. He played 15 minutes in the first half, but played 19 in the second half. And you look at those two guys plus minus. D'Anthony Melton, who is like StatGeek's darling in this year's... He's not going to come out this year, but he's like the new GP2.
Really?
In terms of his advanced...
But is GP2 any good? We should have talked about him when we did the Seattle Players Rundown.
In the D-League?
He's in the D-League?
He is.
Is he on a team?
Yeah, he's on the Real Grand Valley Vipers.
But is he owned by an NBA team?
No.
Really?
Houston waived him and then sent him down to their D-League team afterwards. Okay. So
you're comparing this person to a player who's on a D-League team?
Well, the difference is that like GP2 came in and did this and he was like 30 years old when he came out of junior college.
Yeah.
GP2 is not that old. I'm exaggerating for effect here. D'Anthony Melton is doing this at like age 19, and okay. That's therefore makes it substantially more impressive. Also, NBA scouts be hating on GP2.
Yes.
So,
by the way, we should just be talking about Isaiah Thomas. Why are we even talking about the Huskies?
We'll,
Isaiah Thomas
we'll get to
is
that.
All we should
we'll,
talk about.
We'll
okay.
get to that.
When are we going to get to that? At what point?
After. Okay. D'Anthony Melton in this game, they were plus 20 in the 34 minutes he played. In the 6 minutes he didn't play, the Huskies were plus 12.
Really?
Yeah.
So he didn't play at the end of the first half, I'm guessing?
Yeah, when the Huskies went on a 15-0 run to end the half. That was just after he picked up his second foul, and then he only sat out briefly in the second half. But he finished this game with... 16 points, 7 rebounds, 6 assists, 6 steals.
Damn.
D'Anthony Melton is so good. He is USC's best player. And then Benny Boatwright, they were plus 21 in his 21 minutes of action, in his case, minus 13 in the 19 minutes he didn't play.
Wow.
So those two guys won the game.
So, I mean, the game was all these drastic runs back and forth. Probably more so than I've almost ever seen in any Husky game, where it's like big run for USC, big run for Washington. And you felt like those were happening when Melton and Boatwright were on the bench.
They were, yeah, they were major factors in that. Because Boatwright came in, scored the 7 quick points, drew 2 fouls, went to the bench the rest of the half. USD was still in it. Melton picks up his 2nd foul, 15-0 Husky run to go to halftime. Fans cheering, people excited. And then they just played the whole second half.
Yeah.
So there you go.
And then in the second half, the refs decided not to call any fouls on USC.
That regressed to the mean.
Did it regress to the mean?
Yeah.
Not all that much.
I mean, I think the mean is the Huskies committee a lot of fouls.
How about this? USC realized they don't need to foul the Huskies in the second half.
That's fair.
Yeah, would have been a great win to have. I mean, what else is there? This would have been a very nice win for Lorenzo.
It's too late. I mean, we're running out of chances for the Huskies to win games.
The things that we're cheering for right now, like what I'm cheering for, is not that they win games to set up this season. I'm just cheering for them to win enough games that Lorenzo Romar doesn't get fired.
Yep.
That optically, UW can keep Lorenzo Romar without it being too embarrassing. Which leads us to the reason that we need to keep Lorenzo Romar.
Yeah, this was interesting. Did you hear about the Brandon Roy interview with, I guess it was with Softy on KJR?
No.
And apparently he said, like, they have to keep Romar to get Michael Porter, who he's coaching, which is weird on so many levels. Like, that's probably the weakest possible defense. I mean, that's where Romar supporters are at this point. But I mean, when you played for him, I feel like you're allowed to, like, go a little harder.
I like Brandon Roy going nuclear on the radio, though, just being like, hey, Jen Lyon, by the way, you need to keep Romar to get him.
Jen Cohen,
close enough.
I don't know if I would call that nuclear.
Nuclear? He's like the young Pope out here.
I don't think so.
Backdoor wheeling and dealing.
He never at one point said that we didn't deserve him.
Brandon Roy, I feel like that we don't deserve Michael Porter or we didn't deserve Brandon Roy. Because we don't deserve either.
That's true. It's very true. Yeah. So last week was the major showdown, the rematch between Garfield and Nathan Hale, Michael Porter's team, and Brandon Roy's team. I saw the first matchup between these teams down in Portland at the Les Schwab Invitational, which Hale won pretty easily. Garfield in that one was without UW commit Dejon Davis, who played in this one, a game that was probably the most anticipated high school basketball game in Seattle history, I would say.
In Seattle history.
Yeah, I mean, it was nationally televised on ESPNU. They were full for the gymnasium for an 8 o'clock game at 4 o'clock p.m.
Man, it looked kind of wild in there, too.
It really did. I mean, I've been to the Garfield gym many times. It's not exactly like a big gym because it's a high school gym. And like they have a huge band, which is taking up a lot of it in the student section and all that. So there's not a lot of room for general fans. But that was the hardest ticket in town.
So crazy. And I mean, it was like that was the Husky game last weekend. That's what we were paying attention to.
Yeah.
I cared more about watching that game than I cared about watching their game against Arizona State.
I watched the whole Arizona State game, but I watched more of the Hale Garfield game than I did of UW Arizona.
Did you have any takeaways from watching Nathan Hale Garfield?
So I don't think anything really new with Michael Porter. Like, he floated through the game at times, but still very much made his impact felt, I would say.
He has the ball so much. I'm curious if that would be the case. It's almost like I don't even want to just assume that he's going to be at UW.
We're going to have to discuss it as if he's inevitably going to be at UW.
Okay. At UW, I wonder how much he'll have the ball. Because Markell has the ball a lot, but he's also a point guard.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're going to orient your offense around him. Now, you know, it's going to depend on a variety of factors above and beyond whether he actually ends up there. But if this recruiting class comes intact. Blake Harris is more of a traditional point guard who will probably be sharing ball handling duties with David Crisp, who is probably going to mostly play off the ball, I would assume, next year. And then Porter also surely playing an important role in handling the ball. And then Dejon Davis as well. You know, he's kind of a combo guard type, probably more off the ball at the Pac-12 level. But he definitely made a difference in this game as compared to the first time these two teams played.
Yeah, Garfield's good. Watching them, that was one of the takeaways that I had, is that Garfield is really good and they get almost no attention.
I mean, they're dramatically overshadowed. Jerron Brooks was a much different player in this game than he was the first two times these teams matched up, when I think Jontay Porter really dominated him in the first matchup.
Really?
Yeah.
Jonte had some nice plays. There were a couple of things that Michael Porter did that I haven't seen him do in previous games, which were there was a play where he drew the defense and then hit Jonte for a dunk down low, which I thought was a really nice play that he had. And then Jonte Porter, I was thinking about his outlet passes.
Yeah.
It's like, man, you don't see high school players with outlet passes like that almost ever.
It's true. I'm really excited about Jonte Porter. Granted, he's probably never going to make it to UW. But
no chance.
He'll be a phenomenal player at Missouri.
I mean, I can't even remember the last time that the Huskies had a big man. Well, really, even like necessarily like an athletic skilled big man when the last time that happened was. But a big man who can make an outlet pass.
I will say, by the way, one of the encouraging things to go back to the actual UW team, Sam Timmons, solid couple of games here.
So he had some moments. He had a solid game against Arizona, and I was so ready to say that Sam Timmons had put it all together. And then
just like the Huskies in general, they have a good game.
Things, I mean, like, he's so finesse for being a big man. It's really hard to watch.
For a guy who was playing against New Zealand high schoolers a year ago. It was a pretty good two-game stretch for him.
It feels like we always have these finesse big men. I'm saying, bring back Matthew Bryan Amening. That is the one big man who I want the most of anybody.
Because you didn't think he was finesse? You thought that he was all power?
He threw it down sometimes.
He did throw it down.
He threw it down sometimes. Just these.
I mean, I'm not disparaging him. I'm just saying that if your specific criteria is a powerful big man, I don't know that Matthew Bryan Amening is the number one player on that list.
But some of these plays that Sam Timmons has, you're like, whoa, the putback dunk that he had at the end of the game.
You see what they saw when they got really excited about signing him.
There's definitely some moments with Sam Timmons, and I think
he's so young. He shouldn't be playing that much.
I think he could be a really good player.
I think so, too.
It's nice to not have to see too much of Toure.
Who did not play at all tonight.
Yeah, I've also seen a lot of Carlos Johnson.
Carlos Johnson, he plays so hard.
He plays so hard, but that means that he's taking possessions away from Markelle Fultz.
Yeah, the time when he went like one on three and Fultz was sitting wide open on the weak side, it was like, oh, Carlos Johnson. But you know what? He got two offensive rebounds of his own misses and eventually got to the free throw line of that
position.
Yeah,
that's what he does. Carlos Johnson plays very hard.
Carlos Johnson was a plus 12 in this game.
Really?
Again, he was on the court at that run at the end of the first half, so that factors heavily into it. No one else on the Huskies had a positive plus minus in the game.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. All right. Carlos Johnson. It's like sometimes with Dominic Green, it feels like you're playing 4-on-5 when he's out there.
Yeah. Dominic Green, this was not a not a great showcase for his particular skills.
So frustrating because Markelle was playing so good in front of Danny Ainge. Just like, damn, Markelle, you got this.
All right. So to go back briefly to Metro League basketball, I don't know do you have any other takeaways from that matchup? Kind of a down game for Jalen Noel. He didn't really do much. The third Husky commit that was playing in that game, or 2017 commit, because Porter obviously is a 2018 Jonte. Anything else that you want to add to that?
No.
So
it was a fun game to watch, though. It was a way more fun game to watch than any college basketball game I've watched this year.
Yeah, the pace flows rather nicely at the high school level. And those teams, like, they don't need a shot clock. There is a shot clock in Washington High School basketball.
What is the shot clock? 35 seconds?
It's 35. But they're playing on, like, a 10-second shot clock.
Yeah, that's where it's at. That's how basketball should be played.
So next week is the Metro League tournament. Friday night is the last game of the Metro League regular season. And the semifinals of the Metro League tournament will be played next Wednesday at Heck Edmondson Pavilion. It is your best shot
at seeing Michael Porter. What day?
Wednesday, February 8th.
And it's definitely going to be hail?
I mean, they have to win, I think, their quarterfinal game, or I don't know exactly
okay,
what the bracket
is.
But yes, they're going to be in the semifinal. It would be stunning if Hale and Garfield
can they face each other again?
You know, the Seattle Times said they could, but I don't know. I'd have to look at the Metro League standings, which I do not have handy, sadly.
Okay. I'm going to go to that. Wait, what day is that? February 8th?
Wednesday.
We have to go, right?
I mean, I'm obviously going. I've already, like, organized. There's going to be so many different groups of people I'm going with to this game. I don't know how it's all going to work.
Be floating around everywhere. Danny Ainge is going to be waiting for you.
Something like that, yeah. So I'm very excited about that. Let's see. The Metro League, current Metro League standings. Hale 14-0, Garfield 13-1, Beach 11-2. West Seattle 11-3, Seattle Prep 10-4. So,
wait, how do they have all these wins? Who are they facing?
These teams?
Who are the teams that are losing these games? Well, those are all pretty good records.
Blanchett is 1-12.
Okay.
Ballard is 1-13. And Bainbridge is 1-13. So those teams will not likely be appearing in the semifinals. Franklin Traditional Power only 6-7 this year. O'Day 7-6, so they won't likely be appearing either. But it does not look like it will be Hale versus Garfield. They'll probably be in the two different games and then meet in the final.
Where's the final at?
The final is being played at Chief South.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Would they go back to a high school gym to play the final?
For whatever reason, not for whatever reason, that's being played on Friday night, and that night, the UW women will be hosting Arizona.
I thought you were going to say that the UW men's team was playing, and it's going to be like, cancel the game, move it to Chief South.
So those teams have to win no games, actually. The Hale and Garfield, assuming they do finish 1-2, would advance automatically to the semifinals.
Okay.
So,
well, the UW women could keep the arena for the night.
Yeah, should we talk about them?
Yeah.
Last week, a 90-67 win over California on Friday night, a dominating performance against a pretty good Cal team, and that set up the showdown on Sunday, UW and Stanford, nationally televised, or not nationally, it was on the Pac-12 network. But I don't know, so did you watch?
People could probably get that nationally.
Yeah, to some extent. Did you watch this game?
I didn't see any of it. I'm a little bit sad that I didn't.
I watched the second half while I was also watching Blazers Warriors in attendance there. And it was interesting. You couldn't really tell this from what I was glancing at the TV broadcast, but then looking at some photos afterwards, it looked like it was a packed house in there.
Yeah, I think it's sold out.
That's awesome. So the Huskies were very similar to the USC game, as it turned out. We're up big at halftime. Stanford rallies in the second half and eventually pulls out the 72-68 victory over UW. So now Stanford in the driver's seat along with Oregon State, those teams both with one loss in conference. The Huskies don't play either of them ahead, lose the tiebreaker to both of those teams. They need them to lose twice to jump them in the standings.
There's a Pac-12 tournament though, right?
There is, which is played at Key Arena, conveniently enough. So the Huskies will
How nice.
Essentially have home court advantage at that one. But now their concern is that the team that they have to start worrying about is UCLA, who's tied with them with two losses. UW beat them in Seattle, but they still play again in Westwood. And
I'm opening up this Fred here.
Yeah. If the Bruins win that game, suddenly could drop UW all the way down to fourth in the Pac-12, which would be a little disappointing. I mean, it's not a huge difference because, you know, the difference between playing Stanford and Oregon State is probably not that great. Whoever finishes 1-2 between those two.
And still be likely to host a first-round NCAA tournament game.
I think so, yeah. But definitely not great news. No one else in the Pac-12 is better than 5-5, including the two teams the Huskies face this weekend. They're on the road to visit Utah and Colorado, who are a combined 5-15 so far this year in Pac-12 play. And it's the easiest road trip that you can make in Pac-12 with the traveling partners. So the Huskies currently now number 10 in the AP and coaches poll, but going to need more production from players besides Kelsey Plum, because she had her usual game against Stanford.
Yeah.
It was everyone else who really struggled in this. Other players besides Kelsey Plum combined for 24 points in that game. She had 44. Everyone else had 24, which was a big departure from Friday when Natalie Romeo, the transfer who is kind of an outside shooting specialist for them, scored 32 points against Cal.
Nice. Natalie Romeo.
Plum wasn't the leading scorer in that game.
Wow. When was the last time that happened?
I don't know that off the top of my head, but it's probably been a while.
I can't believe you don't know that off the top of your head. Is it true that there was a crucial moment at the end of the Stanford game where Kelsey Plum didn't have the ball in her hands?
I can't say I remember it off the top of my head.
Okay.
It's probably true.
Well, that's unfortunate. I hope that does not happen again.
Now, the one good thing that did come out of this game, by the way, Kelsey Plum did, with her 44 points, move into number 3 on the all-time NCAA scoring list. So she continues to climb that list. Jackie Stiles.
I thought you were going to start playing some live audio.
I did not know that I was going to click to a video when I was on GoHuskies.com. I thought that was going to be a list of who she passed.
Thank you. We've been failed again by the Husky Athletic Department.
All right. So, yeah, hopefully 2 wins this weekend for the UW women and get back on track.
Okay.
So also, while we're on the topic of women's basketball, the Seattle Storm made a trade this week. This is the start of WNBA free agency, and Wednesday was the first day of that, and really the kickoff of the offseason.
Okay.
And so the Storm traded their first-round pick, number 6 overall, is part of a three-way trade. It ended up with the Washington Mystics.
All three teams of the WNBA made a trade.
No, there's 12. And they also swapped second-round picks. The Storm moves up 3 picks in the second round and gets Carolyn Swords, who was a backup last year in New York and is a player who's had pretty good advanced stats for a long period of time now.
But wait, what does this mean for Kelsey Plum?
Yeah, that's the real question there. So first I'll mention, like, the Storm has really struggled to have size. They have Crystal Langhorne, who's a free agent, but they cored her, so they exclusively have, that's like the WNBA's franchise tag.
Okay.
So I'll bring her back. But she's like 6'2". She's like kind of the power forward who's masquerading as a center. Swords is 6'6". She's like a legit center and then, you know, an efficient scorer. So she'll bring a very different look at the position. So it seems like bad news for the chance of getting Plum. Obviously, she wasn't going to drop to 6, but it seems easier to trade up for her if you have that pick. But yeah, the idea of trading up to get Kelsey Plum is not entirely off the table. So,
We can only hope. And as we do our Husky basketball roundup, can we finally talk about Isaiah Thomas?
Oh, right. Yeah. Yeah. Isaiah Thomas is amazing.
He's officially an all-star. By the last time that we podcasted, he was not officially an all-star at that
point.
That
is true. It was. We were taking it for granted, but a toast to Isaiah Thomas being an all-star for the second year in a row. A good friend of mine who I'll be hanging out with this weekend because he's coming up for the UW-UCLA game, the Fultz Ball matchup this Saturday that will probably not go well for the Huskies.
You kind of made that seem like you were talking about Isaiah Thomas.
No. Anyway,
like, a good friend of mine.
This friend of mine, before the year on the True Hoop podcast, referred to Isaiah Thomas as a, quote, fake all-star because he made it in the East.
Oh, man.
He is not a fake all-star anymore.
That's the kind of hate of Isaiah Thomas that I would expect from only you.
He's getting an MVP chance now.
Oh, hello.
Like, this is out of control right now.
I mean, so they played earlier today.
Yes.
Isaiah Thomas scores how many points in the first quarter?
16 in the first quarter.
And then how many in the fourth quarter?
I want to say 19, but I don't know.
He didn't do anything in between.
Very little in between.
Took off the second and third quarters. I mean, if you would have had a good second and third quarter, you could have easily been at 60 in this game.
But Toronto was ahead, you know, basically the entire way in this one. And lo and behold, the king in the fourth leads the comeback again.
Man. Yeah, Isaiah Thomas, I'm telling you, he is the story of the season. Isaiah Thomas, we need to get to a point where we're calling him Superstar Isaiah Thomas.
I mean, it seems awkward.
It seems awkward, and it doesn't at all. You've resisted this idea. We had a fight this weekend about whether the Celtics should draft Markelle Fultz, were they to have the number one pick. And you basically...
Read about that on ESPN Insider coming Friday.
Oh, really? Wait. Oh, I gave you that idea.
I gave you the idea of
Markelle Fultz being the number one pick. And the potential,
yeah, that's true.
I gave you the idea of the trade with the Nets. but even then, I don't know why I'm trying to get you to be known as hating Isaiah. It's just like you don't love Isaiah as much as you should.
I love Isaiah. I just am realistic about him not maybe being the best player.
Who
in the
is this
NBA.
Person who is calling him a fake all-star?
Tim Von Temps of the Washington Post.
Wow. And so I'll forgive him.
Because it was not his worst prediction.
Because of my appreciation for everything else that the Washington Post is doing.
It was not his worst prediction of the year. He also said the Timberwolves were going to win 50 games
this year. There we go.
So it was important tonight that not only did Isaiah score 44 points, not only did he come up big time and again in the fourth quarter, including the go-ahead three-pointer, or at least the dagger three-pointer. I can't remember if they were behind or ahead when he hit it. There's been a lot of talk about his defensive RPM, his plus-minus, which has not been that great this year.
People trying to find ways to hate.
Plus 16 tonight in a game that they won by 5 points.
There we go. He's like the Carlos Johnson of the Celtics.
He really is. this is an important win for the Celtics, though. Toronto was number 2 in the East most of the year. The Celtics have now climbed ahead of them. Toronto's on a losing streak. Now a game and a half up on them, and it makes it likely that Brad Stevens will be coaching Isaiah Thomas in the All-Star game.
Ty Lue's not doing it?
No, he can't. He coached last year.
Oh, you can't do it 2 years in a row?
You cannot.
Oh, well, look at that.
So.
Wow, that was huge. Isaiah is obviously trying to win it for Coach Stevens.
I mean, I think that's good for his chances of playing a lot in the All-Star game if Brad Stevens is coaching it.
I'm thinking that everybody else has kind of gone all in on the Celtics. It's been a little bit hard for me because I've really hated the Celtics for many years.
By everyone else, you mean our cousin Katie?
And kind of you.
I mean, I was more in on the Celtics last year because they had to live up to, like, the 48-win RPM projection they had. This year, like, the RPM projection wasn't that much better than anyone else. So, I like the Celtics at all. Go Isaiah, but I don't feel as strongly.
You only cheer for teams based upon your projections.
Oh, obviously.
You're only cheering for the computer.
Like, I gotta prove it, don't got glitches.
What happens if Carmelo Anthony gets traded?
The computer, like, what does the computer say about it? What does he say about the computer? I don't know. I don't know.
But I'm thinking about a little bit about going all in on the Boston Celtics.
You should do it. It's a fun bandwagon to join.
I was thinking earlier about every loss is more devastating for the Huskies because I don't follow an NBA team closely. And I feel like if you're an NBA fan, you get a little bit more used to the slog.
That makes sense. Yeah, there's way more games. You can't get as hung up on each individual one.
Yes.
The other thing I feel like is, like, every time Isaiah plays better, like, the Huskies currently play worse.
They play worse.
It's like a correlation between those two.
This goes along with your theory. Wait.
That it's the Husky football team that has caused the basketball team to be bad.
Yeah, maybe it's Isaiah Thomas that's causing the basketball team to be bad.
It could be. I can't rule that out.
It's definitely, you're coming up with any reason to say that it's not Lorenzo Romar.
No comment.
Say, you're like writing stories. No, like this. It's Chris Peterson's fault. Clearly, that the Husky basketball team is.
This effect predates Lorenzo Romar.
Okay,
it goes back to the Bob Bender era, good sir.
Does it really?
It sure does. Because guess what? The last time the Husky football team was this good, the Husky basketball team was really bad.
What about when the Husky basketball team was good?
The Husky football team was bad.
Really?
Yeah, it's indisputably. Like, the correlation is indisputable, and correlation, I have always said, is causation.
Okay. It's indisputable. And also, Isaiah Thomas is making the Husky basketball team worse.
Yep.
Anyway.
Should we talk about the Sounders?
Yeah, let's talk quickly about the Sounders.
So, a roster move for the Sounders this week as they continue their training camp. They have signed Gustav Svensson.
Mm-hmm. We've been scouting him for years.
Have we?
Yeah, stretching back to 2003, 2004. Really been waiting for this move.
A Swedish international who plays as a defensive midfielder will probably provide depth there for Osvaldo Alonso and Christian Roldan, who are established as the starters. He comes to the Sounders from the Chinese side Guangzhou RNF, who had to cut him loose because the Chinese league changed their rules on how many foreigners you're allowed this year.
Which seemed kind of strange to me. I thought China was going all in on soccer.
I guess they're just going all in on, like, paying two players per team or three, since that's the limit. But yeah, it's crazy since there's, like, rumors of Diego Costa going to China. Like, it's one thing for Obafemi Martins to go from the Sounders to China, but to go from Chelsea, like, the Premier League leaders to China, that's a whole nother thing.
Yeah, it's also, especially, I didn't realize that. Before I'd seen this news about Gustav Svensson, I didn't realize that the Chinese league was limiting the amount of foreign players that you could have.
Which is not unusual. Like, I'm used to that from basketball. There's often limits on those. And technically, there are in the MLS as well. So, for example, Sounders defender O'Neill Fisher got his, I don't know if it's his green card or his citizenship. I should probably check that. But he got one of those this week.
It's
and now,
been taken from him now.
Well, now he no longer counts against the import quota. He counts as an American player. So there you go.
He counted.
In other Sounders news, Steve Zakuani.
Wait, is this happening?
Is attempting a comeback. He's like been training with the team. And then he went down with them to Tucson, where they're having continuing their training camp and then preparing for preseason matches starting soon. So this might be a thing.
I'm all for it.
Straight from the TV halftime show back onto the field.
Yeah, just like John Lynch going to be the 49ers GM.
Not exactly. Not
more,
exactly the
more
same.
Or less the same thing.
But a Sounders legend, so it'd be cool to see him back on the field if he can still play.
Love Steve Zakuani.
And then the other thing that happened, this is the international break, and on Sunday, the U.S. men's national team, first game under Bruce Arena, their new head coach, new manager against Serbia, and Chad Marshall got the start.
Nice.
His first appearance since the, I believe, 2009 Gold Cup?
Since Bruce Arena was last the coach.
Pretty much. Yeah, he's been one of a number of MLS players who have been out of favor in the Jurgen Klinsmann era and now getting a chance again. Jordan Morris came off the bench in that game. Brad Evans did not see action, but it has been part of their training camp. And then the other bit of news was that Arena said that no matter what happens with Clint Dempsey, who is continuing to train with the Sounders in hopes of making his return, he will not be called up in March when they next have an international break.
Okay.
So there you go.
All right.
I think that's it on the Sounders.
Yeah, that was very thorough Sounders news.
It was. All right, let's wrap up the roundup portion of this with the Seahawks. Two bits of news.
There's Seahawks news.
Number one, Wall Street Journal article, leaping over the snapper, according to an NFL spokesman, will likely be among the league rules under review this offseason.
Okay.
And they speculate that the Super Bowl may be the last time that particular play is legal. And if so, we can talk about this later, but a real competitive disadvantage for the Seahawks.
Do you think so?
No, not really, but okay. It would be a bummer.
It felt like the Seahawks, we argued about whether the Seahawks invented it or not, which...
They did not.
They did not.
But they popularized it.
Popularized it, for sure.
They're the Columbus of jumping over the snapper. Troy Polamalu is the Leif Erikson of doing so.
And... I mean, they really perfected it for a moment there.
They did. They did. And it I can't say it won them a game. It tied them a game.
Went halfway to winning them a game. It's huge. I'm okay with that. I mean, at the same
honestly,
time,
it does seem super dangerous. Like, I don't want to give Bruce Arians too much credit.
When somebody jumps over the line.
It's an exciting play. But there's a lot of things that are exciting and also dangerous, and the NFL generally moves to outlaw them.
Yeah. Okay. And what is the other bit of Seahawks news?
So Russell Wilson took to Facebook Live yesterday while he was at a barbershop getting his hair cut for, I guess, his appearance on Conan. I think he was on Conan yesterday. And had some comments on the state of the country.
You said Russell Wilson is now woke.
I said, is Russell Wilson woke? Because, let me tell you, Russell was... inscrutable with his like politics the first few years he was with the Seahawks. And I think that led to naturally some questions about what his politics might be, some speculation.
His wokeness. I was even thinking about this the other day for some reason, and then he came out. It's like at least partially woke.
Yeah. It was, you know, I think in Russell Wilson fashion, it was mostly about like, you know, how can we unite around a common ideal? But still, for him, this was basically the equivalent of kneeling at the national anthem or something.
It was amazing how he managed to work in the separation is in the preparation.
And he ended with go Hawks?
Yeah, go Hawks.
But, you know, I think it's great to see athletes in every sport speaking out, mostly basketball. I would say is primarily the leader here. And it contrasts with Roger Goodell's message of, I'm just trying to focus on the Super Bowl.
Or Tom Brady's message.
Yeah.
I mean, I was wondering, should we talk about the Super Bowl for a second, by the way?
Yeah, we probably should talk about it for a second.
Okay, first off, like, how much of a villain is Tom Brady right now? Tom Brady, to me, like, everybody talks about the revenge story against Roger Goodell. They're in the same boat. They're on the same team, and Bill Belichick's on that team also, right? But the Atlanta Falcons and the city of Atlanta ain't on that team, right?
I mean, it's hard to imagine how one could be rooting for the Falcons much more. Like, come on.
There are so many reasons. Like, you know, you go through your residual hate for the team that knocked you out of the playoffs. It's hard not to, at least for a little while. But man, do I love the Falcons right now.
But like the sting of losing to the Falcons in the second round of the division round of the playoffs does not quite compare to losing the Super Bowl to the Patriots. That wound is still fresh, as we found out when Richard Sherman spoke out.
In basically every way.
Did you want to talk about the Pro Bowl either?
No.
Okay.
No, I did not.
Richard Sherman looked fully healthy. That's all I've got to say.
He looked great out there. Jimmy Graham almost got into a fight in the Pro Bowl.
Really?
Yeah, he took real offense to a tackle, which I kind of think he was right to. It was a way too hard tackle against Jimmy Graham in the Pro Bowl. But here are the reasons why you would cheer for the Falcons.
Okay.
Basically, the Seahawks of the South.
Yes.
Right?
since the Jaguars attempted to be the Seahawks in the South, it did not succeed.
That didn't work.
Didn't take.
I don't know who they're going to be in the South now. What the new plan is.
I don't know who is coaching the Jacksonville Jaguars at this point.
Yeah.
Oh, Doug Marrone. They promoted Doug Marrone from interim coach,
they're the
right?
Syracuse of the South.
Okay.
wait, who's that Syracuse? Ryan Nassib? He'll be their quarterback. Seahawks of the South.
Yep.
Patriots being the worst. Politics of the Patriots being the worst.
Show Atlanta. General Atlanta Renaissance.
Atlanta. Gucci Mane. Migos. All of these things, right?
As I like to call it, Black Portland.
Black Portland. I haven't called it that in a long time. Forgot about Young Thug.
Yeah.
Right?
How can you forget about Young Thug?
I'm always forgetting about Young Thug.
It's because he didn't show up for the shoot. That's why.
All of these reasons. Do you have a perspective about what's going to happen in the game?
It seems like New England's defense is slightly more equipped to stop Atlanta's offense than Atlanta's defense is equipped to stop New England's offense, I guess would be my takeaway. It seems like the big key to this game, Atlanta all year, yards after the catch. New England, same thing, offensively. New England's defense is very good at preventing yards after the catch. Atlanta's defense is not. That to me is probably the key to the game. Danny Kelly, our friend at The Ringer, wrote a good piece about how it probably will come down to the turnover battle and pointed out that the two of the five times, I believe, in modern Super Bowl history that the team that won the Super Bowl, the turnover battle, did not win the game.
Really?
Seahawks in 2006, Seahawks in 2015, or 2014.
Okay, and the Seahawks, this is only the Seahawks of the South participating, not the real Seahawks.
Yes, yeah, no. that was his fun fact, which did not turn out
great,
to be very
this
fun.
Is not that fun.
No, not
fact.
So fun. Okay.
I think the Falcons are being a little bit underrated. I think the Patriots defense in particular is being very overrated. I mean, because people keep pointing to like this team defense stat that is not really statistical in any way.
The points per game, yeah. I mean, that's obviously irrelevant. But if you look at their DVOA, like over the period where Atlanta's defensive DVOA has gotten much better, New England has still gotten much, much, much betterer. Mm-hmm. That's I'm a writer. Than Atlanta.
Okay.
So that to me is what I'm kind of leaning on here.
I still think they're going to have a really hard time stopping that Falcons offense.
I mean, I think it should be a good competitive game, which would be a departure from the rest of the playoffs.
Yes. We can only hope. But it's just like the pressure is so high when you play the Falcons.
You got to stop them?
You have to score every possession.
I mean, the other
going
thing is
to score.
At some point they are going to miss a third down. Like, eventually that it has to happen.
I don't know.
Logic demands it. Like, you can't convert every single third down. It's just not possible.
I mean, I don't... Like, I look at these Patriots victories that they've had in the playoffs, and I think that they're pretty weak victories. And I look at the Falcons victories, and I think that they're pretty good victories that they had. I mean, they really crushed the Packers.
They did.
Who were a very good team and came in very hot, because you just need to stop the Falcons every single... You either need to score every single time you touch the ball, touchdowns, or you need to stop them at least a couple times.
And that's, to me, the other factor besides the turnover battle that's somewhat random game to game and will decide this is red zone efficiency. I mean, you're probably not going to win this game kicking a bunch of field goals.
I'm very curious to see if we see this Falcons offense where it feels like there's just somebody open on every single play.
Yeah.
I mean, we saw it against the Seahawks. We saw it against the Packers. I don't know if I really see, aside from Bill Belichick
Belichick. Those were not good defenses. I mean, the Green Bay secondary is terrible. And then obviously the Seahawks secondary was not very good after Earl Thomas was injured. Oh, come on. Isn't that a hot take?
The Patriots defense? That's what we're talking on here. Do you remember when we played the Patriots? CJ Pro-Size.
Do you remember when we played the 49ers?
Okay, sure. Not that much.
Yeah,
I remember that one.
I also remember watching the Falcons game.
but CJ Procise went wild against the Patriots.
That is true. And
do you think
Devontae
stop
Freeman, Tevin Coleman,
and Tevin Coleman?
It's like having two CJ Procises out there, neither of whom is injury prone.
Man, we should get one of those. I think the percentage chance of victory is like 47%.
Oh, yeah, we should have done this. Okay, I'm going to say like 40% for the Falcons.
I think they're probably the underdog, but not by much.
Well, that would be a good game if it's really that close.
I believe that they're going to score a lot of points. I don't believe this defense narrative.
All right.
Anyway.
I mean, I do believe that as well. I just think New England is going to score more points. Let's wrap this up with our recruiting, our signing day spectacular. Can we call it that?
Yeah, of course.
Okay.
I called it that earlier.
Good. That's probably where it lodged in my brain. The Huskies signing a recruiting class of either 17, I guess 18 players. 18. We're going to count the one player to decide on the Huskies on the day of Jordan Lolohea, who is going on an LDS mission and will not be part of the team for the next couple of years, but is part of this recruiting class. He's the 18th player and ranked number 22 by ESPN, which graded it 6 4-star players, 12 3-star players. I thought it might be interesting to compare that to past seasons under Chris Peterson, mm-hmm. Coach Pete. Last year, they were number 29 with 8 4-star players, 9 3-star players, which seems like it's better, but I don't know. Maybe the class as a whole
other, was other better. Teams affect that too.
2015, they were number 28 with 4 4-star players and then 19 3-star players. In 2014, Coach Pete's first year when he kind of had to start late, number 45 with 2 4-star players, 23-star players. Also, that class already has put 3 players in the NFL now.
Yeah.
Who left early. So,
And one of those 4-star players was Buda Baker, who will be a first or second round pick this year.
Yep.
Also from that class, there's Sidney Jones.
Yep.
Kevin King.
No, Kevin King would have been the year before. Elijah Qualls was the third guy.
Elijah
class.
Qualls. Yeah, what do you think about this class in the macro?
So, I mean, here's my. Let's start with what I think about recruiting.
Okay.
What I think about recruiting is, like, there's too much worry about individual players because it's pretty random whether an individual player is going to be good unless they're, like, you know, once you get to, like, that Buda Baker level, like, then it's pretty clear, like, you've separated yourself. And there's, you know, maybe one guy like that in this class, I think.
Okay.
But it's about the overall quality of the class and the depth of the class is a pretty good predictor. And then there are some coaches who are able to consistently exceed their recruiting rankings.
Yes.
And Coach Pete and his staff pretty clearly on that list, and maybe at the top of that list based on what they did at Boise State and so far at UW.
Yes.
So when you see a number 29, number 28 class, like the 2016 class, too early to judge, but the 2015 class, number 28, that produced Jake Browning and Miles Gaskin. Like,
yeah.
Like they're going to get guys. So if it's a pretty well-rated class, that I feel great about.
I mean, what you're talking about right now is the highest-rated class of Chris Peterson's tenure at UW.
Yeah.
And these previous classes led them to the college football playoff this year.
It's true.
It feels like that's kind of getting lost in the mix right now.
I don't know that it's getting that lost in the mix.
But recruiting rankings only matter so much. I mean, there are teams who you don't see consistently at the top. Clemson is a team, the current national champion, who you don't see as... I don't even think they're in the top 5, top 10 this year of recruiting classes. Sometimes you need to be able to coach players also.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, when you're taking players that are so young and so raw, talent is only half the battle.
Yeah.
So recruiting matters. Coaching matters probably more. It's probably 60-40 coaching to recruiting. And then also finding the right kind of guys. So I don't want to take this for too much. But at the same time, I feel like there were some missed opportunities in this class.
Yeah, obviously you're disappointed that a couple of the top guys from the state of Washington got away. And, you know, as much as everyone likes to talk about, well, let's build a fence around the state of Washington. Like, these are 18...
Hopefully people are going to use different terminology.
No, that's a valid point. These are 18-year-old kids.
Or build a fence and just move away.
These are 18-year-old kids who have unique desires and... you know, things they want to do. Like, not everyone wants to play at home. Like, some people want to get away, and yes. You're not always going to be able to get everyone.
In the same way that we want to be able to go into other places and pluck players from Los Angeles and places like that.
Portland.
Yeah, we just want to dominate Portland. we've talked extensively about Foster Sorrell, right? Where there was a real opportunity there for the Huskies that they couldn't do.
But maybe there wasn't. Because there wasn't much more they could have done.
No, and I'm not saying that they could have done anything differently there. But there were just that, him, and then also losing at the last minute to USC, one of the gems of the class, in Marlon Tuipulotu. Right? One of the top players in the class who flipped to USC in the last couple of weeks. And it's really frustrating.
Connor, let's throw Connor Weddington in there. That was the other person I was thinking of from the state of Washington who also ended up at Stanford. And
also Connor Weddington also going to Stanford. So having those three players, two of them flip late and one of them announce late, it's like it didn't quite finish in the exact way that we wanted it to.
No.
But I think the effect of this college football playoff, it wouldn't be felt right now. It'll be felt next year and the next year and the next year.
Oh, especially because most of their recruiting work was done before the throes of this season. I mean, you look at a lot of these guys committed last April.
Yes.
So that's kind of how this UW staff is going to do it. They want people that are really committed to the University of Washington and not necessarily people who are deciding at the last minute.
And
okay, geez.
But before we get into the individual players, the one thing that we need to say is that similar to how we just trust in Pete and John, like we don't know that much about players that the Seahawks are drafting, but we know, and also signing as unrestricted free agents, but we know their track record and who they have gotten in the past.
And we know that the undrafted free agents will ultimately end up better than the guys they draft. No.
But we know that in that mix, there are going to be people who are like Richard Sherman, who are like Doug Baldwin, who are like CJ ProSize, right? And in the same way, you take Chris Peterson and you just have confidence in Chris Peterson and his staff that they're going to find those players who you're discussing. Like Sidney Jones is not that highly rated of a player, but he's being drafted. He's going to be drafted ahead of a lot of people who are rated higher than him.
Including Nigel Hale, who's at Montana State now.
Is he at Montana State?
Yes.
Hey, they're like the UW of Montana.
He's going to play with Darren Gardenhire next year.
So anyway, let's talk about that being said, let's talk about these players.
Yeah, so I thought the best way to do this was to kind of break it down by position, the number of guys who are returning, the number of players who left, and then the recruits at that position. So we start with the skill position where most guys are coming back. At quarterback, the Huskies bring back their entire depth chart with Jake Browning backed up by KJ Carter-Samuels, Tony Rodriguez, and then 2016 recruit Daniel Bridge-Gad, who redshirted. And to that group, now they add yet another Jake.
Montlake Jake.
In the long tradition of Huskies named Jake. The long, sometimes good tradition. Jake Haining from Danville, California.
I mean, you know he's going to take over the quarterback position from Jake Browning because his name is Jake.
It is foretold.
Jake Haining feels like the protege for the Husky quarterback. This feels like the guy. I would not be surprised if Daniel Bridge-Gad transfers after the season.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, they're different styles of quarterbacks. Like, Bridge-Gad is more of the dual threat, whereas Haney is more of the traditional drop-back quarterback. So
they could both be around there. You know, their classes. And they're not in the same class, but
you're also probably going to look at next year's recruiting class in terms of adding a quarterback. Like, they're always going to sign a quarterback.
You got to sign a quarterback every year.
Yeah.
But I think Jake Haining does feel like the heir apparent to the Husky quarterback position.
I mean, I think that's a little premature to say, I would say. I mean,
at running back?
But I mean, I think the thing we should look at is the possibility that Jacob Sermon, who's already committed to UW from Bothell for next year's class, he might be the guy. He's a four-star recruit, like much more touted than Haney is.
Is he the one who's Peter Sermon's son? He is. Nephew?
I don't know. Also, the Huskies have two Sermons in next year's recruiting class, apparently.
They're all related.
Yeah, I don't know. That's way too far out for me to figure. I can barely handle this year's recruiting class. Okay. Like, this is not my thing.
All right, let's leave the Sermons to the young pup.
At running back, again, the entire depth chart returns. Miles Gaskin, LaVon Coleman, Jamon Dotson, and then two 2016 recruits who redshirted last year, Sean McGrew and Kamari Pleasant. So not a major need immediately, but the Huskies did add one of their highest-rated recruits in Salvin Ahmed from Kirkland in Juanita High School, who's rated the number 10 running back in the country by ESPN Sports Nation.
Huge player. Think he'll redshirt. Probably won't see him next year.
There's some possibility. It seems like that he might move off of running back. They you know, the coaching staff, it seemed like their comments was, you know, he's really excited about the opportunity to play running back, but not like that's a sure thing
where he's going to end up. In his heart, he's a running back. I think that was the Chris Peterson quote. He was wearing a sweater vest. No, it was not all too unlike the look that you have going on right now.
I mean, this is not a vest. But yes.
At the Husky game, were people fired up when he came out?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, there weren't that many people there, but they were fired up.
The few people. Danny Ainge was feeling pretty good about it.
I tried to get a good photo. I didn't get a good photo.
Those were current recruits who came out also at the beginning of the Husky basketball game, right? Or were those current Husky football players?
I believe they were current players. I'm not sure if recruits were included.
If they can do that legally?
I don't know.
It's complicated. I was going to say, it was like, wow, what a special opportunity. You committed to UW, and now you get to throw t-shirts to 4,000 people in that head.
All right, wide receiver, where we do finally have a departure in, obviously, the form of John Ross. Also, Drew Before, who I don't think was on scholarship, but occasionally saw some playing time. The Huskies bring back 9 wide receivers, led by Dante Pettis, Chico McClatcher. And then I think the future of this position is really the last year's freshman class, Quinton Pounds, Andre Pichelia, and Aaron Fuller, who saw a lot of playing time last season. But to that mix, they add 3 recruits, all of whom are pretty highly touted.
So there they have Terrell Bynum, who is related to John Ross? Friends with John Ross?
I think he's just kind of like a John Ross type.
Okay. John Ross definitely is familiar with him personally.
Based on his tweet today, yeah.
Yeah.
So he played at St. John Bosco, which is the same school as Sean McGrew, but they didn't play together. He transferred in this year after McGrew left.
And then Alex Cook coming in from Sacramento.
Mm-hmm.
And Ty Jones, who was there was some nervousness around about him potentially flipping at the end to UCLA.
Yeah, a late run from UCLA, but reaffirmed his commitment on Tuesday night ahead of signing day.
He said Johnny Nansen, who's now at USC, was texting him up to last night.
Oh.
Which feels illegal to me.
No, I mean, that's not.
Okay. But it's felt like the last 3 or 4 years, the one position where Coach Pete never feels settled is the wide receiver position.
I mean, I think he felt pretty settled with the Ross Pettis combo this year. Like, they were pretty damn good.
Even at the... It still felt like there could be more from the wide receivers.
But I would say that there are 3 positions where recruits could come in and have an impact right away.
Yes.
And wide receiver is one of those spots. These guys will push last year's freshmen for playing time.
One of these players will play this year.
Yeah, I mean, it'd be surprising they didn't. I mean, Bynum could come in and be a return guy, even if he doesn't play a whole lot at wide receiver right away.
And then Ty Jones got a lot of love late. He, I think, at least one of the sites, the recruiting sites, moved him from a 3-star to a 4-star recruit late.
Which shows how important that distinction is.
Yeah, it's not like the most arbitrary distinction. You're like, he's a 3-star recruit. And it's like, ooh, a 4-star recruit. But Ty Jones is somebody who got a lot of love late in the recruiting process and feels like the type of player who, I mean, Coach Peterson finds players like that who tend to, people discover them a little bit more further down the road.
Okay. At tight end, the Huskies lost a couple of players. Jarrell Daniels, who was the primary tight end last season, although it was definitely rotation. And then Jeff Lindquist, who was probably more important as a holder and starting that one game at Hawaii at quarterback. Mm-hmm. Bring back 4 players, Drew Sample, David Ajimu, and Will Disley will all be upperclassmen next year. And then Michael Neal, who has yet to play and will be
a redshirt
sophomore. Yeah. Had not heard of him either.
Okay.
But here is, I think, maybe the player with the single best chance of having an impact next year from Bellevue and Eastside Catholic, Hunter Bryant, who was rated the number 2 tight end in the country by scout.com and the Huskies' top recruit overall.
The prize of the recruiting class at one of the most important positions for the Huskies this year.
Yeah, I mean, and also, so they brought in 2 other guys, Kate Otten, who is a 3-star, and then Jacob Kaiser, who was part of the 2016 recruiting class, but then opted to gray shirt and delay his enrollment until the start of the spring, the winter quarter, I guess. He is currently enrolled in school. But those 2 guys are more blocking tight ends. Bryant is the receiving tight end who kind of steps into the role that Jarrell Daniels, who was originally recruited as a wide receiver, filled.
And I think we could see him starting, maybe not being listed as the starter, but being listed in one of those situations where they have it listed as,
or
it could be Drew Sample or Hunter Bryant.
Yeah.
And I think that he is going to play a lot on this team and could be an important player.
I think so too. All right, offensive line. The Huskies bring back 12 players. I don't know if we need to list all of them, but they lost Jake Eldrenkamp, was the one starter they lost. Presumably will replace him with Andrew Kirkland, who split time last year, and have kind of five starters with experience because Nick Harris ended up starting last year as a true freshman. So this year is really more about developing depth down the road, and they add three offensive linemen, led, I would say, by Sammamish and Skyline product, Henry Vainvalu. Vainvalu?
Seems right.
Okay. There's an I in there.
And then the other couple players that they brought in both came in late. Seems like they were waiting out Foster Sherrill for a little bit. And then once that happened, they had late offers to both Jackson Kirkland, with Husky pedigree.
Yep.
With his dad playing
offensive line for the Huskies.
And then immediately after Foster Sherrill announced he was going to Stanford, they offered to Cole Norgard, and he came on immediately. But so having the opportunity to bring in two pretty solid offensive linemen, three-star offensive linemen, who both, I think, have gotten a lot of attention late in the recruiting process and picked up offers from many. I mean, Jackson Kirkland is flipping from UCLA, who have a hell of a recruiting class.
Yep.
And bringing in those two guys late, I think that these are going to be starting offensive linemen for the Huskies in the future.
This is always one of those positions where you can never recruit enough offensive linemen.
You should always sign a million offensive linemen.
That's the new money ball.
After, it really is, right? After, especially if you can get just giant hogs of offensive linemen. After the Alabama game, I said to you that the difference between Alabama and UW and the difference between elite programs and a program like UW is that they have huge players at offensive line and defensive line.
Who they allow to redshirt and then like develop for 3 years before they ever get on the field for most of the in most cases.
And also just size being a difference. Not huge players as in recruiting ranking.
Yeah.
Size of players. Literally, a lot of teams can get wide receivers. We talked about this a lot. You can get 3-4-star wide receivers. Many teams have those. Getting 3-4-star offensive lineman is a hard thing to do. So bringing in these players is huge, and some of the most important players in this entire recruiting class.
Yeah. So it sounds like Vainvalu was recruited as a guard, and he's probably got a chance to compete for a starting spot next year after Kirkland graduates. Kirkland and Norgard being looked at as tackles at this point.
But there's going to be competition throughout the whole offensive line.
Thanks, Coach B. On the defensive line, Huskies lose Elijah Qualls, who went out early, and Damian Turpin, bring back eight players, including Vita Vea, who I don't know if we ever kind of followed up on him debating entering the NFL draft and ultimately deciding not to. And then also Greg Gaines, who was more or less a starter last year, and then Jalen Johnson, who came on towards the end of the year and in the bowl game when he got healthy.
This group's going to be a monster next year.
And so to that group, they add a... After, as you mentioned earlier, Tui Peloto flipped to USC, then they offered Ali Gay from Edmonds Woodway, who was described by them as a beast and kind of the like ideal physique you want in a defensive lineman. Okay. 6'6", 250, I believe.
It feels kind of like, you know, you like describe your new girlfriend or something. Like, they're like, oh, but he's a beast. It's like, we don't need you. You know, it would have been nice to have kept Tui Peloto, but bringing somebody in, there's a lot of depth here already. It would have been nice to have maybe brought in a little bit more depth along the D-line, because again, it's another position where you can't ever have too many players.
I mean, it's interesting, because I think actually you physically can have too many players, because most of the time the Huskies only play two down linemen when they're in nickel. Like, they essentially play a 2-4-5 a lot of the time.
Man, mixing in defensive linemen, though, is so huge.
It's true. You're going to have more rotation at that position than almost any. So in that 2-4-5, the rush positions are outside linebackers, and they lost both starters there last year with Joe Mathis and Saul Muching. We're able to get a lot of experience for Connor O'Brien, Benny Mpotuahe, Tevis Bartlett, playing in place of Joe Mathis after he got injured, but those guys are going to be really counted on this year. And then to that group, they add two recruits incoming this year, plus, as we mentioned earlier, Lolo Hea, who will be coming after he goes on his LDS mission, those being Ariel Nata from Folsom, California, and then Joe Tryon from right here in Renton, Washington.
Renton, Washington.
Hazen High School.
Hello.
Yeah.
Home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle
your
Seahawks.
Your old stomping grounds in the Highlands. So Tryon was a guy who they flipped from Wazoo relatively late in the recruiting process. Not listed at 6'3", 200. Going to have to add some size to play at this level, but we'll have some time to do so.
Okay.
Yeah. Middle linebacker, a spot where they did not add a single recruit, did not lose a player. It's the exact same eight players coming back. Azeem Victor, who will be back for his senior season after he had his season ended early by injury. Keshawn Bieria, who started all year. Ben Burkervin, who ended up starting when Victor went out. And then also the return of Sean Constantine, who missed all of last year due to injury, but was a promising reserve before that.
And this is a place where the Huskies had a great recruiting class last year.
Yeah.
And I think it would have been weird if they would have brought in players this year.
So they were able to recruit Camilo Eifler, who was one of their biggest recruits last year, a four-star guy. And you would think that, you know, with two seniors in the mix there, we'll see whether Sean Constantine gets a sixth year of eligibility and might be a starter in 2018. But if not, I think Eifler will definitely push for a spot there.
I could see some of these players shuffling and playing in different places.
Yeah, I don't know about that.
There's a lot of players there to play.
There's a lot of players there, but I don't know that they necessarily... Maybe Eifler, he was originally recruited as more of like a rush-end type, so you never know. And then Brandon Wellington, who did play last year mostly on special teams, he came in originally as a running back.
Yeah.
At cornerback, the biggest departures, they lose four players from last year. Sidney Jones going out early, Buda Baker, who I'm listing as a cornerback because he played nickel corner, let's be honest. And then Kevin King is exhausted his eligibility. And then Darren Gardenhire transferred at the end of the season, ended up at Montana State, as I said earlier. So they still have six guys coming back, but then add two recruits, both of them generally considered four-star guys. Elijah Molden from West Lynn, Oregon, who's the son of a former Oregon cornerback, and chose UW over Oregon. And then also Keith Taylor from Anaheim, California.
I mean, basically anytime we could take a player from Oregon, it's great.
Yeah. I mean, this was like a very important symbolic gesture and then also important in player terms. I mean, I think listening to what they said about him, defensive back coach Jimmy Lake said, opposing offenses will have a difficult time figuring out where he will be lined up. That seems to me they're mostly thinking of him as like the eventual Buda Baker replacement in terms of like nickel corner, which is a really important position in the modern college game.
I like the idea that you're lining up defensive backs to try to trick offenses.
Yeah, I don't know.
I'm confused about what Jimmy Lake is doing.
But so I think if there's, besides wide receiver, and we already mentioned Hunter Bryant,
yeah,
the other position where guys have a chance to come in and play right away is cornerback, where they'll really be competing with last year's class that, because of their depth, the Huskies were able to redshirt Byron Murphy, who was another one of their highest rated recruits, and then also Kentrell Love and Isaiah Gilchrist from last year's class. And so they'll be competing with those guys. Austin Joyner and Jordan Miller bring a little more experience to the position and probably are the favorites to start on the outside.
Yeah, and we have no reason to be down on those recruits. I mean, we were talking about some highly rated players last year.
Yeah.
I think Byron Murphy and Isaiah Gilchrist were both four-star recruits last year and have had another year in the system. No reason to think that they are not ready.
All right, safety. So if we don't consider Buda Baker, the Huskies lost just Brandon Beaver, who was a senior. They bring back the starters, JoJo McIntosh and Taylor Rapp, who took over midseason, and then have experienced depth with a pair of seniors as backups in Ezekiel Turner and Trevor Walker, but did add then, because that's kind of an older position other than Rapp, a highly rated four-star recruit in Brandon McKinney from Orange, California.
And this is the place where we saw a freshman making the biggest impact, being the MVP of the Pac-12 championship game when Taylor Rapp.
Yep.
So it goes to show that freshmen can make a difference right away. And also Taylor Rapp, not that highly recruited of a player. And coming into next year, probably the sophomore that we're most excited to see.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
So an opportunity here for, especially in the secondary, right? No matter basically what position you're playing, there's opportunities for everybody there between the redshirt freshmen, between everybody who's coming in all the way through Brandon McKinney.
Also, if there's one place you're confident about Coach Pete and the defensive staff coaching guys up,
yeah,
it's secondary.
Feel pretty good about that one. I mean, looking at the players, Marcus Peters was a good player before Coach Pete got here, but still, he was a first-round draft pick in the NFL.
Yep.
And then you have this year three players from the secondary who probably will go in the first or second rounds, all of whom were recruited and coached by Coach B.
No, Kevin King was not recruited by him. We already went over that.
Wait, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, he was. We went over that?
He was part of Sark's last class.
Okay.
Jones and Baker were his first class. All right, then special teams. The Huskies lost Cameron Van Winkle, their semi-reliable kicker, and bring back kickoff specialist and punter Tristan Vizcaino. Van Soderberg, who was part of the 2016 recruiting class.
And whose full name sounds like a last name.
It's true. Very much so. He did not see any action last year, but I think is probably the favorite to be the starting kicker this year. I would guess Vizcaino focuses on kickoffs, and then they bring in junior college punter Joel Whitford, an Australian who I'm just going to guess here. He's an Aussie-style punter, which I think that's a position they probably wanted to upgrade after Vizcaino struggled as a punter this past year.
Like, they took the Aussie-style punter very literally.
Well, I mean, a lot of those guys are.
They were like, oh,
coming from the rugby tradition. And then they also got a preferred walk-on, Peyton Henry, a kicker slash punter who's pretty highly rated as well.
And teammate of Montlake Jake.
No, yeah.
Former teammate. No.
Also, one thing I learned in this exercise in trying to determine how the Huskies have allocated their scholarships, did you know they have a long snapper on scholarship?
Wait, really?
And here's the best part of this. It's A.J. Carter, who was, I think, a part of, I think it was the 2015 recruiting class. But he didn't even play most of the season.
He wasn't even the long snapper.
He ended up long snapping on punts at the end of the year, but it was Luke Hutchison, a walk-on, who served as the primary long snapper last year.
Well, look at him.
So there you go.
I'm sure.
The more you know.
I'm sure his frat was very excited.
We had a conversation. I think this was mostly offline, but we had the conversation about how like Seahawks fans are so obsessed with the long snapper, and it's like no one ever knew who the long snapper was before Twitter.
If you would ask me who the Husky long snapper was last year, no idea.
This is a great example of that. Like, for some reason, that's just a Seahawks thing.
We are really consumed with the Seahawks by who the long snapper is, because we want to blame somebody else for Steven Hauschka missing extra points.
I don't know about that. I mean, people were concerned about that even back in training camp. I don't know. They're just very sensitive.
I'm trying to think of
snapping.
Every long snapper that I can name. I mean, J.P. Darche really like owned the long snapper.
He was
position.
Solid. He was solid. All right. I think we've got reached long snapping. That's probably a good note to end on that note.
Thanks for listening.